Welcome, one and all, to the latest installment in what I think is shaping up to be a really groovy, a really thought-provoking thought leadership podcast. It's called Renewed Thinking. And if that's what you thought you were tuning into, well, I can confirm you are in the right place. We're on all the major platforms right now, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and of course the Radio Life and Style app, where this is also a live radio feature. My name is Mike Charles, and in conversation this morning with my special guest, the CEO of Skin Renewal, Victor Snyders. Victor, welcome back to episode 3 already of this rolling, rollicking, freewheeling audio thing. How are you doing?
No, thanks, Mike. Great. Everything is good. Really enjoying these organic.
Organic. That's the thing.
Podcasts.
I love that word, and I think that it's a really great format that we've got here. Sort of a loose structure. We sort of think we know where we're going, and then we start talking, and sometimes it stays the course. Sometimes it veers off into a very interesting adjacent direction. Today, building on the back of where we ended off with our last podcast, which sort of focused predominantly on the health, wellness, and the beauty world and the state of that landscape globally and locally right now. But something that became a really strong theme in that last podcast was the importance of relationships in building a business that lasts, that goes the distance, and that can survive the ups and downs, the turbulence, and the storms that any business will surely face if it's still going after a year or two. So I figured this would be a good moment for us to look at relationships in business and understanding who you're in a relationship with. Because if you as a business think you know who you are and what you do, how well do you know the person you're serving? How well do you know your customers?
So if you remember back in our first podcast, we did the 3 W's, and one of them was the who.
Yeah.
I think it's really important that when you start any business, you get that who right at the beginning, to know who is your business actually aimed at. Okay, because it's all very well opening a business without that in place and then discovering who your business is aimed at, and maybe your offering isn't right for what it evolved to be. And you need to keep a track as to who that customer is, to know that either you are hitting what you're aiming for, or that you may need to change your target and change the way you run your business. So I think that question of who right at the beginning is a core thing that you must have established, even if the who does change. And there may be reasons why it changes over time. The second thing is, unless you're in business completely on your own, and when I mean on your own, I mean on your own, you're a one-man business.
Yeah.
You answer the phone, you get in your car, you drive to the people that phoned you, you fix their plumbing, you give them a bill, you go home. That's a one-man business. The moment you have one employee, you have something different on your hands, because now every single person who works in that business must treat the customer in exactly the same way.
Uh-huh.
Because you're only going to be as good as your weakest link. And if you remember, once again, off the first podcast we did, one of my golden rules for business is, firstly, treat yourself as an employee. And number two, treat your employees as yourself. You cannot expect your employees to care about your patients if you don't care about your employees. Because then the whole thing will collapse.
Bottom line.
And you see this often in businesses, where the business has stopped caring about its employees, and the employees have stopped caring about the customers, and then suddenly the business wonders why they have a problem with their customers.
When you spell it out like this, you know,
so simple,
it makes perfect sense. It does seem so clear and so simple. Do you think it's vitally important that a business leader schedules time to sit down with the team and say, "All right, do we all have the same idea of who our customer is?"
It's absolutely critical. One of the very first business books I ever read, and this was in the 1970s, the late 1970s, when business books didn't appear in bookstores. You know, the only things, there was Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich, and there was Dale Carnegie, and those were probably the only two business books. But the first serious business book that came out in the 1970s was a book called In Search of Excellence. And what they did is they researched some of the major corporations in America to try and find out what was the secret that made those businesses so much more successful than others. There was General Electric. There was one of the motor companies. There was an airline company.
Big corporate America.
Yeah, this is the days before the Microsofts and all of those things. And IBM was the tech company.
Oh, yeah.
And what they got at the end of the day was the most significant thing that was that applied to all of those companies was something they called MBWA, Management by Walking Around, where they said that all of those companies had CEOs that did not sit in their office all day, but actually were on the shop floor.
Okay.
Because by doing that, you are seeing what is going on in your business. So, and it's something that someone like Raymond Ackerman used to do, where it's something I know that the guys who started Dis-Chem in South Africa, they do it.
MBWA.
They are there, and on a Saturday morning, they will go and sit in a quiet, unobtrusive spot on the corner, and they will just sit and watch. And watch the things that are happening. And that way they can see what is going on in their store. They will walk around in nondescript clothing, not identified as the CEO or the founder of the business, and just ask, oh, I saw that you took those tomatoes off the rack, but you put them back. Why did you do that? I'm just interested.
Yeah.
okay. Just looking at behavior. But, and that is having your finger on the pulse of the business. However, that's not enough. Because you can't be everywhere all the time to watch everything that's going on. So you need information. And information really gets broken into two categories, quantitative and qualitative.
All right.
Quantitative is nothing but data.
It's the numbers. Okay.
It's the numbers. And the detail is in there.
Okay.
So you have to know the numbers of your business. And it doesn't matter what kind of business it is. What does it generate? Income per hour, income per day, income per ticket, what is your retention rate of patients, what is your repeat rate of patients, and how is that basket made up of? You ask any grocer, he will be able to tell you what his average basket is. You have to know that, and you have to know whether those figures are moving up, moving down, moving sideways, and where the changes are taking place. This is a purely quantitative exercise. You don't need to be in a store to understand those things. These are the things that the bean counters have to do, and you've got to use tools, okay? Because if you just get spreadsheets full of numbers, they will bewilder most people. Yeah. To most people, numbers is not a language. It's but nothing more than an irritation.
Luckily, we live in the age of data number crunching, and there are lots of tools that can draw up graphs and charts and make sense of just a bunch of spreadsheet numbers.
But that's quantitative stuff. You're going to have data. You're going to have dashboards that help you interpret that data, business intelligence systems, and you will be able to track those things. So once you have the quantitative stuff there, you will know what the numbers of your business mean.
But it's only half of the picture. It's
only half of the picture. And this is where some businesses go wrong when they are completely run by the bean counters.
Yeah.
Okay. Because the bean counters are disconnected from the business. They're connected to the numbers, but not the business.
Okay.
The qualitative stuff is the stuff you need to know. And that you will know by being in the business, being active on the floor, by talking to people in your industry, your suppliers, your customers, and continuing to do and start. There are so many things you can do. You can run secret shopper systems. You can run focus groups. But there is nothing better than actually talking to customers. It's something we've been doing for 20 years. If I'm in a branch because I'm visiting the branch on branch-type issues, I will always try and spend a little time in the reception area talking to customers, asking them why they came to us, what made them come, who's looking after them, what's their level of service. just ask those kinds of questions. Sometimes the answers you get are not the answers you want to hear, but they're the answers you have to hear. Yeah. And if you are not in touch with the customer, and there's that relationship. Mm. Now, that doesn't mean we're besties. Okay, we're not going to go and watch the rugby test together and then go and celebrate or commiserate after the rugby test. But you have to know your customer, and that you don't know from the data. Where this becomes very, very challenging, when you have a single entity business in a single location and you are there, then you are generally in touch with what is going on in your business because you're at the coalface all day. You understand your staff, you understand your customer, you're involved. You have to, out of time, out of work hours, you have to dig into the quantitative data to see whether that all ties up, but it's all right. Mm. But here are the two areas where we start getting problems. Number one is in the franchise model, very often the person who buys the franchise doesn't work full-time in the business. And by full-time, I mean 8 to 5, 7 days a week or 6 days a week, whenever that business is open.
Yeah.
Okay. And they start becoming shareholder owners who visit the business once a week or twice a week and think, and they will lose touch with that business. Mm. The other one is the business that tends to grow and start opening multi-locations. So they think that here I've got a business that is operating well. I'm focused. I'm in it every day. I know exactly what's going on. Let me open another branch.
Replicate the formula.
That's it. Copy, paste. Okay, let's put that idea aside for a moment and talk about raising a family.
Okay.
So you have your first kid. Child number one comes along, gets 100% of the attention from mom and dad for two and a half years, okay, 100%.
There you go, happy.
Their entire lives, there's a novelty, okay, because it's their first kid. They're exploring, they're learning, they're enjoying, they're celebrating every little milestone, whether it's the first time the kid had an ice cream or the first word or all of these things.
Sleep deprived, but loving it.
Absolutely. Now kid number two comes along. And suddenly the dynamic changes.
Yeah.
Because now kid number one was used to getting 100% of the attention. But kid number two needs a lot of attention because they are still 100% dependent. Yeah. They can't do anything for themselves. Okay? But they can't get 100% of the attention because kid number one still wants some attention.
Still exists, yes.
Okay, so let's say that kid number two gets 70% of the attention.
It's a big drop for kid number one.
Well, kid number one, when they were growing up, got 100%. Kid number two is only getting 70%.
But kid number one's down to 30% from 100.
And kid number one is down to 30%. Let's complicate it and have kid number three.
Oh, my word.
Okay, so now kid number one is maybe down to 20%. Kid number two is down to 30%, and kid number three gets 50%.
This makes for an interesting family dynamic.
Okay, but and this is something we do with our kids.
Yeah.
Okay. But they're all in our home. They're all in that same room, or you can at least hear and whatever. But now we're doing the same with business. So we open branch number two. But now your attention is not on branch number one. And it's not in the same place. It's somewhere else.
And the crowd that you thought you were going to be serving in location number two, to your amazement, might actually be different people to the location number one people you were serving that you built your business model around, right?
So now you have to spend a lot more time at number two to get it on track, to understand it. But that means you're not at location one anymore.
Oh.
So then things start going and, you know, what do they say happens when the cat's away?
Oh, the mice, they are at play.
Absolutely. And we see this so often where the rate of growth of a business has been driven to a point where it cannot be sustained. You've got to build slower. Mm. You've got to be really sure. You know, it would be ideal if we could have our second kid when our first kid is 18 years old and has gone off and left the nest. because then we could do it all over. But unfortunately, the procreational cycle does not allow for that. And what you find in large families is a very interesting dynamic, because even a family that has 8, 9, 10 kids, it is the old kids that land up looking after the younger kids.
This is true.
Or the middle kids, so that the parents can give their attention to the youngest of the kids. But what has happened is you have built a system within the family.
That's kind of self-supporting.
Yeah. But in business, it is quite different because you're not in the same location. The only thing you can use is systems and technology to keep an eye on things.
So let me ask you, because you have built a very successful multi-location, nationwide business operating in some very nuanced and different markets, still within South Africa, but there are many South Africans, as you know. And how have you been able to scale and still keep your finger on the pulse of what's happening in each of your branches?
The answer is easy: by making lots of mistakes.
We're going to learn from them. That's why we're talking here.
It was exactly this. We opened our first three clinics within a one-year period.
Wow.
Okay. But we had no idea what we were doing. In retrospect, I can say that. We thought we knew what was going on. We didn't.
So if you were to with the learnings you have now, do it all again, you wouldn't open three clinics in 1 year?
Not a chance.
Okay.
Not a chance. Because the reality is that all of them took a lot longer to bring to maturity as a result of that. Because our attention, and in those days it was just Maureen and myself. We had no infrastructure. We had no support teams. We had no middle management. And there were two of us. We could not be in three places at the same time. We could only be in two. And we were just running from one end to the other. Every single day was a crisis. Okay? And there were 20 crises every single day.
Wow.
And we were just putting out fires.
How long did it take for you to reach a space of equilibrium where the fires stopped being 20 a day, where you could catch a bit of a breath? Has it stopped ever?
You know, you're asking an entrepreneur what drives them. It's the fun of the whole thing. Learning when you've made a mistake, to accept the mistake and be prepared to fix the mistake, instead of being determined to be right and prove that you were right and the world was wrong. That's an exercise in futility. Mm. So don't be scared to do things, but be prepared to learn lessons. We could have done much better in the first 5 years of our business than we did. The advantages we had is we were very early entrants into this industry. That was the first advantage. Second advantage that Maureen and I had is we were both much older. So we started this business in our mid-40s. And as a result, our kids were grown up. We were empty nesters. For us, putting 14, 16-hour days in was not an issue because we didn't have a life to balance.
Okay.
Okay.
So there's something to be said for that.
Yeah. Our 18-year-old kids didn't want to hang around with us anyway. They wanted to do their own thing. They only came to us when they needed their laundry done or when they needed money. But outside of that, they had become relatively independent. We also didn't have a need in the first few years to generate an income for ourselves. So we were able to work without a wage for the first 2 years. And that was absolutely massive. Because had we been 25 or 30 years old, and we still had to purchase a car, make a house payment, send the kids to college, deal with medical emergencies, and all of those nice things, then we would have had to have a salary.
Yeah.
And we were able to sacrifice a salary at the beginning. And that meant we did not need to be profitable from day one.
So it gave you, I guess, that wiggle room to make those mistakes and to learn by doing in the first 2 years.
If we had set this business up 20 years earlier in our life cycle, it wouldn't have succeeded because we would have had to draw money out of the business. In order to survive. And we didn't need to do that for the first 2 years. Then our own funds ran out and Now we needed living expenses, but we were able to draw on the business. But after 2 years, you have to know at what point a business is profitable.
Yeah.
Because until that point, it's a loss. And how much loss can you take before you've got to close the business? Mm. Because loss means you've got to put money into the business every year in order to function.
Yeah.
So you've got to know what that mark is. The best we've ever done was brought a clinic to profitability in 9 months.
Wow.
Our worst case scenario took 5 years.
Wow, wow. But in that initial run, you had a runway of 2 years to get you to altitude, and after that, it was off to the races.
Yeah. And of those clinics, the first one that opened has been moved twice and a third time, so has shifted three times. The second one still exists today, and the third one has moved twice and been expanded about four times beyond what its original size was. So only one of those even resembles what it did 18 years ago.
Wow.
Or 19 years ago.
And I imagine that the markets that you were operating in 19 years ago have changed. I mean, just in terms of the dynamic of the customer.
The demographics have shifted entirely. You know, I talk from a real perspective because I can only look at life the way that life happened to me. The reality is I'm male, I'm white, and I grew up, my first 10 years were in 1960s South Africa. That was the reality of what I lived in. If I saw someone running in the street, it was because he was getting chased by a policeman because his pass wasn't there. That was the reality. In those days, nobody jogged.
Yeah.
Okay, there were no joggers. If there was someone on a bicycle in a street, it was someone delivering groceries or a kid going to school.
That was it.
There was no such thing as a cyclist. Okay, those were the realities. I had three radio programs I could choose from, no TV, and the newspapers were created by the state. Without any outside influence, I could not see the world as anything different from the way it was being presented to me. Mm. So I came at life with that bias, because those were the biases that were formed in my formative years. Going to university and national service in the army suddenly broadened horizons. Okay?
You could see other South Africa's other possibilities.
So I could see in the national service in the army, one extreme, and at university where there was free thought, a complete different thing. But by then, you're already in your mid-20s. And now you've got onto the hamster wheel. Because now you're supposed to, you know, the Cat Stevens song, Father and Son. Find a girl, get married, have a family, get a job, join the rat race. And that's exactly what happened. So that was the South Africa that I grew up in. Now I'll give you a very real example there. Growing up in a white environment, which was of European extraction, and my family comes from the Netherlands. We were Dutch speaking. Mm. We did the Dutch culture. We ate Dutch food. We went to the Dutch club. We celebrated the Dutch holidays and the Queen's holiday. We did Christmas the Dutch way. And this was our community. My first wife came from a German community where they went to the German club and they celebrated the German holidays and they did all the German things. And I could identify the Dutch community, the German community. I went to a school which was predominantly Jewish. So Friday nights, I used to visit all my Jewish friends. I went to shul with them. We had Shabbos with them. I learned their cultures. And I could identify that. I knew the Italian community. I knew the Greek community. I knew the Afrikaans-speaking community. I knew the old British colonial community. And I could look at all these groups within what was only a very small part of South Africa being the white community,
yeah,
and differentiate. And here we're only talking about being able to identify in a person. It goes much further to understand the behavior, the cultural significances, and why people function in the way that they do. So what we discovered, here I sit now in my 40s, and we open this business, and we're getting customers who are white, and we're getting customers who are black. Now, the reality is, in our business, this is very significant, because this is a different skin.
And okay? You can't necessarily use the same strength of a laser
the
on
skin
one.
Skin is a different, it has different melanin in it, it is a different thickness, it has different levels of hydration, it is structurally different. There are things you can do to one skin that you cannot do to another skin. And whilst we could learn the technical side of how to treat a skin that was different, I did not understand the customer.
There was some homework that was needed.
Because quite frankly, and then we developed. In South African parlance, there was a word that came out. It was called the black diamond.
Yes.
And then customers, businesses that had catered exclusively to a white market, suddenly started getting black customers, and they put them all into one basket called the black diamonds. And that was insane. Because that market was as nuanced, if not more nuanced, because there were 11 different languages, there were 11 different cultures, and those were only the main cultures. There were many subcultures. And there was a huge thing because the concept of the family was very different in those communities to the community that I grew up in. Many of those communities were built on migrant labor, sending funds back to a family unit, matriarchal in terms of the upbringing, multi-generational, because those people didn't put their old people in an old age home. Mm. They looked after them. Yeah. And in fact, those gogos helped look after the children so that the middle generations could go and earn to pay and put food on the table.
Yeah.
So there were completely different cultures and completely different mindsets that I had never been exposed to in terms of my own upbringing and experience. So for me to make assumptions about how they are, how they live, how they think, how they react, based on my background, is arrogant in the extreme. We started holding focus groups to try and understand. We do customer segmentation. We have more segmentation in our darker skin types now than in our light skin types.
Wow. That's amazing.
Because there are far more complex structures that are at place to try and understand those customers. And there are archetypes and customer segments that exist there that do not exist in the world that I grew up in 1960s white South Africa.
Man.
But it's given us that nuance to try and understand those people. And we will never be those people because I did not have that formative thing. But accepting, just simply acknowledging that the way I grew up in South Africa was privileged. Okay, schooling cost my parents R2 a year. And I went to a decent school. My parents were immigrants. They arrived in South Africa with nothing. But as white people, they didn't need very much. They could get a loan from the bank. And they only had to pay R2 to send me to school. And it was all provided. And I had the opportunities and whatever. And being able to recognize and acknowledge those things that I benefited from my birth, but trying to understand it from other people's perspective, completely changed the way that we looked at our potential customer pool. And the reality is, we're in South Africa. South Africa is one of the most astonishing countries in the world to be in business in, because it is an absolute melting pot of religions, cultures, languages, ethnicities, history, that is quite astounding. It's more in South Africa than any other country I've visited.
Really?
Absolutely. You know, they say America is a country of immigrants. Maybe 100 years ago it was. Now America is Americans who are generally white. Then there are black Americans, and then there are Spanish-speaking Americans. And it is virtually polarized along those things. South Africa is so much more interesting. The cultures, the food, the people, the systems that are at place. We have such a level of diversity in this country that continuously astonishes me. Yeah, South Africa is one of the only countries in the world where I can walk anywhere and greet people, and they will greet me back.
Really?
Try and get onto a New York subway and greet someone. You'll probably get stabbed.
Wow.
Okay. If you're on the London Tube, just don't make eye contact with anyone. Stay focused on your Kindle or your phone or whatever.
Don't look up.
Here, you get into a lift that has got 10 people in it. You say good morning to everyone. You greet them. And you start communicating with people. And when you communicate with people, you start learning about them. And people like to talk. They will love to tell you their story. Everyone has a story.
This is amazing.
So get to know your customer. Communicate. Go and talk. Go and start talking to people. Go and find out who they are, where they come from, what is their history, what is the family. One of the first things we do now when we employ staff, I don't care what their qualifications are. I'm interested in who were your mother and father? Where were you born? How did you grow up? Tell me about your family. Tell me about your brothers, your sisters. Tell me about the schools that you went to. Tell me about your experiences in the first 10 years of your life. Because those things are what formed your character.
Yeah.
We employ now on character. We can always teach skills.
And once you start to figure out who you're talking to and all the different flavors of customer that exist, I mean, I imagine you in your focus groups have come up with your own unique labels and subcategories that probably no other business segment has cracked or figured out or identified, maybe just because they haven't done the exercise.
We have a lot of fun with our segmentation because we give these segments, and we currently have 34 customer segments.
34 different customer segments.
In South Africa. And they have very interesting names. There's the Lion Prowler. There's the Lunchtime Mom. There's all sorts of segments, and they are segmented. Sometimes it's by race. Sometimes it's by age. Sometimes it's by education. Sometimes it's male or female, gay or straight. There are all these segments, and we have a lot of fun with the naming conventions, and we train our people in understanding these segments. But the core to this, and we go back to podcast number one, the very first question was the why.
Mm.
Okay. Our why was to touch the lives of the people we come into contact with. That was our why. So doing what we do came very easy to us because it is our why. It is why we wake up every day. Okay. If the why was money, then you don't care about the people. We care about the money so that we can connect with the people, which is our why. If you get that why right, then that always acts as your radar. And when you go, of course, why am I doing this? Because it's profitable. Hang on a sec. Why does it improve the lives of the people that we come into contact with? The answer is that to you is yes, right. Then we can carry on with it. But if it doesn't do that, then don't do it.
What are you in this game for? This is really, really interesting. So for anyone taking this to heart now and thinking, wow, okay, it's time I started doing a focus group, time I started figuring out who we're talking to, or even just, what did you say? MBWA. Get on the floor and start bumping into people and asking questions of your own staff and then of customers, and figure out who it is that you're serving so that you can do the best job of serving them, right?
Well, I take you guys as an example. Your studio is in the shopping center in the heart of Ballito. All day long, you have people that walk past, that open your door, that talk to you, that are your customer. They are your listener. You are connected to them. If you were sitting in an office building in a sterile studio, but you were never touching those patients, or in your case, listeners, you wouldn't know who they are. You would start making assumptions.
And there would be a disconnect for sure.
Yeah. And you've built relationships. I watch the things happening in your studio and I see people walk past and they just open the door. Hi, Dave, how's it going? And he says this and this. And we have a talk about something that happened and how do you feel? Got time for a cup of coffee? There is a connection.
That's it. It's such an interesting thing. Once you start to appreciate it for what it is and see the power in connecting and as being a foundation for building relationships, building trust, and building a business.
I look back in my father's business. My father was an antique dealer, and he opened an antique store, and he opened one in a shopping center in Johannesburg called Hyde Park Corner, which was owned by an old family called the Berman family. And Peter Berman, who was the patriarch of that family, had his office at the center. Every single day, Peter Berman walked into my father's shop. And he said, "Hi, Pete, how's it going? How's business?" Some days he had a cup of coffee. My dad, every day, drove to the bank. And once a week, he met his bank manager. And the bank manager knew where my father's business was, whether he needed a loan, whether he didn't need a loan, and it was built on those relationships. Now, in today's world, if you're a tenant in the shopping center, you talk to some person somewhere over a telephone who might be hundreds of kilometers away, who's completely disconnected. And if you talk to the bank, you'll be lucky if you talk to the call center. Okay, we have lost those connections. One of the reasons this center is so successful is the owner of this center has his office in the center, and he is in the center every single day.
There you go. We're recording this in the Lifestyle Center in Bolito, and absolutely.
It's a vibrant, energetic center, which has had its challenges, same as every center has, but it keeps adapting and reinventing itself, and this center is brilliantly run because the owner is here, and he's in it, and he's in touch with the shoppers, and he knows what's going on.
And there you have it, that direct connection, that human interface. And because it's become a sort of a disappearing factor, it makes it all the more valuable, all the more impressive when it is delivered, when it's executed. And it can really be a point of difference, especially if you're operating in a crowded field. I mean, like you were saying in our last episode, how the wellness and beauty space has just seen an absolute swell of small operators who have seen that it's having a low barrier to entry. But what separates them? What puts them apart? And after a year or two, most of them are folded. They don't go the distance because they don't have these fundamentals underpinning them.
So the lady that I did the podcast with in Los Angeles, lady by the name of Terry Ross, and Terry Ross was brought in to run and manage a Medi-Spa in Beverly Hills.
Sure.
Okay. In Beverly Hills, within a 2 kilometer radius, there were over 200 Medi-Spas. Okay. There were over 300 plastic surgeons and dermatologists within 2 kilometers. They were in buildings 10 stories high with 3 spas per floor. So 30 spas in the same building. And Terry was brought in to turn a business around that was floundering, that was on the verge of Chapter 9, bankruptcy in the US. And she looked at this and she said, but we're all, and I'm sorry to use her words, but she said, we're all doing the same shit. We're all doing injections. We're all doing boob jobs. We're all doing this. We're all doing that. We're all doing the same stuff. And these are all very good doctors, competent doctors. How do I make what we do in our spa against 240 competitors within a 2 kilometer radius different? That was her challenge. And her answer was customer experience. That was it. Simply by treating the customers differently and better and building those relationships, That was what did it. And they landed up over a period of 3 years. She ran that spa, turned it around, and they sold it at a couple of $1 million profit.
Wow. So that there's a proof of concept right there.
Absolutely.
If you lead with that, if you are relentless in the pursuit of delivering a quality experience against competitors that are very competent in what they're doing, but if they are not, and if you are focused on making that customer feel like they are being seen and they are their needs are being met and that they are valued and that they just want to come back to experience your care again, you're going to win in the long run.
If you don't care about your staff, your employees, they won't care about your customers. If you don't care about your customers, they won't care about you either.
Now is a good moment for some self-reflection if you're a business owner and a business leader. Time to do a little bit of an audit of yourself, your team, and your customer base, and figure out if you really know who you're dealing with and if your team really knows who they're dealing with and if you are aligned with who you all think you're dealing with and how you can make their experience as a customer the best it can possibly be in whatever sphere or industry you're in. Because at the end of the day, you're in business to serve, you're dealing with people, and you want that return business. You want them to keep coming back. It's so much more of a win when you can service that one customer and you get to understand their needs and you can dial it in and they keep coming back. Because there's all this stuff, the acquisition cost.
Well, I mean, we happen to know the numbers in our industry, which I won't share in this forum, but the cost of acquiring a new patient is not insignificant if that is done purely through marketing. But the cost of retaining a patient is a fraction of that. So working with the patient base that you have, minimizing your leakage, maximizing your customer retention, and then if you're getting new patients or new customers, that will create growth for the business.
Hey, it sounds like a recipe for a really exciting new chapter in business. And it sounds like it's setting us up for another exciting episode in this podcast. And you're catching this delightful digital audio experience and renewed thinking, a thought leadership podcast and a radio feature. And you've been listening to me, Mike Charles, in conversation with Skin Renewal CEO Victor Snyders, giving you more than a few nuggets of gold there, more than a few things to chew on and to think hard about and to put into action. Because, hey, it's no good us just talking about it here. This is for you, dear listener, to take to heart and to test out. And you'll be all the better for it. Your business certainly will be. In the next episode, we're going to be taking things in a sort of technological direction and looking at embracing technology and innovation, because you can't really shy away from it. You can't avoid it. It's happening. It's arriving. It's here. And if you get on the bandwagon, like my friend Victor, who is an early adopter of note and a man who embraces technology, you might find that it gives you an extra string in your bow and even more of a competitive advantage in the world of work. But that's a story for our next episode. Victor, until then, you just stay dialed in.
Thanks, Mike. Great being here.